So I'm hoping Kathleen and Kathy are there.
I'm here.
Yeah, I'm still
Kathy.
Here.
Okay, great. So hello, everybody, and good afternoon. This is Tim Brennan. I'm the Treasurer Chief Financial Officer of the Association. And you have joined the quarterly UU Common Endowment Fund Investor Call. And today we're going to hear from Kathleen Gaffney, who is the chair of the UUA Investment Committee, from Kathy Mulvey, who is the chair of the UUA Socially Responsible Investment Committee, and a little bit from me. And then after we've heard the presentations, we'll open up the lines for your questions and hopefully our answers. So the investment committee just met, and we had quite a good, robust meeting, and so we'll hear from the two chairs about the meeting and what was accomplished, and also about the portfolio and how it's doing in these volatile times. So with that, I'll turn it over to Kathleen Gaffney.
Okay. Thanks, Tim, and welcome, everyone. I am going to start off with the performance, which is on page 3.
Oh, and let me just quickly jump in and say, if you registered for the call, we sent you a copy of the presentation. If you didn't register, that's fine. Go to uucef.org, and over on the right column, you'll see a link to the presentation. So sorry to interrupt, Kathleen.
No, thanks, Tim, for communicating that. So looking at performance, this is gross performance, so it's before fees, and we're looking at how well we did relative to our peers, and our peers are other endowments in the $50 million to $250 million asset range. Our portfolio is close to $200 million, so we're at the upper end there. And what you can see is in the most recent quarter, our performance put us in the 10th percentile with our peers. So very strong performance, which is always nice to see in the short term, but the committees are focused on our long-term performance. So just taking a look at fiscal year to date, the 1 year and the 3 year, all of those time periods, we're either in the first or second quartile. So very solid numbers relative to our peers. And the 5 year number and the 7 year number are still good. We're median and we were in the third quartile for 7 years. So reflecting some volatility in the markets going back primarily to 2011 and 2013. And then the 10-year number, again, solid long-term numbers in the second quartile, which means that over that 10-year time frame, our composite returned 10% annually versus the fifth percentile, which was 11.6, and the 25th percentile at 10.3. So really very, very good standing. And I think that speaks a lot to our disciplined rebalancing and the work we do with NEPC, our consultant. You'll notice on page 4 that the returns here are also on a gross basis, so not net of fees, and this is on a calendar year basis, so you can see the year-to-year performance, and most years outperforming our peers and in good standing. The meat of the numbers is really on pages 5 and 6, and this is where we get to look at the overall numbers, but how are the individual managers and our asset allocation performing overall? So it gives us a real, a deeper look into the composition of the fund. Looking, I'm going to focus on the long-term numbers as I think they're more relevant, although you will see the 1 month and year to date are certainly solid numbers as well as fiscal year to date. And I'm going to look at that second line, second green line, which shows our composite net of fees. So this is where we're taking the fees out, and you can compare that to the two numbers below that. So on a one-year basis, net of fees, 5.2%, beating the allocation index and the policy index. And on the equity side of the fund, good numbers coming from domestic equity, 14%, in large part due to Rumline, which uses our criteria for ESG criteria from Sustainalytics, and really posting very strong numbers at 11.3 versus 9.1. And then Sands, which is our growth manager, who has really been a large contributor over time. Again, growth equity has done very well. 1 year basis, 21.4 and versus the Russell 1000 at 17.4. Very comparable numbers looking out on the 3 year and the 5 year. Again, much of it led by Rumline and Sands, which is also where we have our highest allocations on the domestic equity side. Moving to the bottom half of the page, looking at our international equity managers, the European equity markets in particular have been challenging, but on a 1 year, 3 year, and 5 year basis, we are still producing positive returns, 2.9 for the 1 year, 9.9 for the 3 year, and 3.9 for the 5 year, all of them outperforming the benchmark, which is a broad international equity benchmark, the MSCI ACWI, which is all cap world index. MFS has been a solid contributor. You can see 1 year, 3 year, and 5 year, strong returns relative to the benchmark, particularly the 1 year where they were up 4.4 in a down market, and then in a very strong market over the last 3 years, producing 12% versus 7.2. So we're very pleased with their performance. And then Baxter Street, which is a relatively newer allocation, also provides returns of 8.7 and 12.9. RBC is our emerging market equity, and they are also relatively new. In fact, probably one of the newest managers that we've added, and their performance has been okay, but as I'll talk in a few minutes, we are implementing some adjustments to our asset allocation and looking to increase emerging market exposure, but we'll be looking for a manager that is more complementary of RBC's style and strategy. So good returns on the equity side, and if you turn now to page 6, we can focus on fixed income. Fixed income has done very good work over the long term as interest rates have come down. If you look at the 7-year number and the 10-year, 5.6 and 2.9%, in line for the 5-year number, and 3-year number is okay, but these are very low returns. Fixed income is generally, we like to think of it as the ballast in an overall portfolio. And because this is an endowment fund, the fixed income is only 20% of the allocation. And the expectation going forward is that these low returns will likely continue. And so the lineup of our managers is one to get exposure to just traditional core fixed income, but on a smaller allocation, and really try and take advantage of more opportunistic, active fixed income managers. Fixed income is probably one of the few areas where you can really add value in an active way, and worth ferreting out those types of managers. Brandywine. Yeah.
This is yep. Tim. Can I just ask you a question while we're talking about fixed income? So I was just at a investment committee meeting yesterday on a different fund, and the manager was talking about how in fixed income, we usually think of it as like the safe haven, but that these days there's actually a lot of risk in fixed income, partially, I guess, because of the direction of rates and the unpredictability. But we have developed kind of a strategy with our fixed income with this group of managers. Can you just give a little higher level view of what we're trying to accomplish here and cut our downside risk on this asset class?
Absolutely. That's a great question. We do see challenges to fixed income and the likelihood that you really can't think about it as that anchor to windward and the safe haven. The returns that we've experienced over the last 1 to 3 years, generally 2%, that's the long-term expected forecast for traditional high-quality fixed income. And I think the what makes it less safe and riskier these days is that as the central banks are moving away from supporting the market with stimulus, quantitative easing, we're seeing governments and politicians take over, and fiscal policy is becoming a much bigger driver of where rates and economic growth is headed, that in order to keep growth going, the fiscal spend is likely to increase. Certainly in the U.S., our budget deficit is increasing, and the volatility that we've seen just in the last week, and looking at today's equity market with the trade war risks starting to really weigh on the equity markets, this also poses longer-term problems because protectionism is likely to add costs, that the costs of a trade war in the long run are likely to add to inflation. Inflation is really a negative headwind for fixed income. And when your coupons are so low and you're only expecting to earn 2%, even just a little bit of a pickup inflation can really hurt your portfolio. So the way we're managing that is we have selected a group of managers who are more active but have different and complementary strategies that are balanced with more traditional fixed income coming from Breckenridge with their corporate and treasury portfolio. Now, that's been the ad allocation has come down to 7% because U.S. corporates and treasuries, their rates are so low that as rates go up, we're expecting those to be more of a headwind. But then when the market really gets challenged and there's concern about recession, the treasury should do well. But the other, what I would call our fixed income opportunistic managers, Brandywine, Loomis Sayles Multisector, and Franklin Templeton, Brandywine is top-down global with sovereign and corporate, tends to be a higher quality portfolio. And so there will be some sensitivity to rates, but it allows us to diversify away from U.S. interest rate risk specifically. And as you look at the return patterns over the most recent time, you can see that they're really, they don't correlate together. So that difference in strategy provides some ballast. Loomis Sayles is primarily well known for excellence in credit, a real value investor focused on fundamentals. And so credit can be a great source of additional return, and this is a very well-respected manager. Franklin Templeton is also a very active fixed income manager looking globally, but with a bit more focus on emerging markets, where we actually are seeing in difference from the developed market rates market, inflation coming down in many of the emerging market countries like Brazil and India. And Franklin Templeton has done an excellent job over time. It has allowed them to be successful in identifying sovereign credits, so both developed and emerging, and that gives us some good returns there that while in some respects look similar to Loomis because of the global focus on currency and sovereign gives us a real complement there. So I think being able to look for different return drivers in fixed income that can help us provide some ballast, but in a different way than we're used to historically, which has been go up in quality and adjust your duration, and treasuries will offset any risk in the equity markets. That's unlikely to be what the future looks like. So I think we've really positioned ourselves well for the future. And then in the opportunistic investments, this has always been mentioned on the call, and we generally get questions. We've talked about GMO, and as I get into discussing what we talked about last week at the committee meeting, we made a decision to terminate GMO and... and we're going to shift those funds out. So what will happen is that opportunistic section will be available for real tactical opportunities, but GMO will go away, and Cevian Capital, which is actually really a European, a focused European equity manager, is going to move into our international equity allocation. And I think that will be, at least from the questions that I've had over the years, a fairly good source of comfort to many of you who are looking for a clearer understanding of our allocation and the types of managers that we're using. So it is more straightforward, I think, and yet I think we're tapping into a lot of really great expertise and managers, as you can see from our performance with our peers, that is a reflection of the size of the fund and the expertise of our treasurer and CFO, as well as the committee. So we're all working very well together. Page 7 is a smaller part of the fund. We have our private markets, which we have been very patient about implementing into the portfolio. Most of these, we've been able to find opportunities either on the debt or venture capital side, that the equity side, that allow us to align with our mission. So this is a way of earning good returns. It is less liquid, but because it's mission aligned and has the potential to really add some value, you can see on a 1-year, a 3-year, And a four-year basis, since this is a relatively new development on our part, it really adding value in terms of those very positive returns. The funding takes place over time, so the custom benchmark is really, I think, more of a guide towards what the return set is in the current market. A lot of money has been flowing into private markets, and that's one of the reasons why we continue to be patient, disciplined, and really more focused on finding opportunities that are aligned with our values. And community development and cash to meet our spending, coming distributions to many of you. So in general, I think we're positioned well. We did spend a fair amount of time talking about asset allocation and how we wanted to implement that. Within the joint meeting, and so with regards to the asset allocation, as I mentioned, we're going to terminate GMO, and in the meantime, we're moving that money into an index T-bill fund, so really looking at high-quality liquidity. It would be a part of our fixed income allocation because it's T-bills, but looking at short, high-quality, liquid investments for part of that money to go into, whether it's a community bank or a fund that focuses on shorter duration fixed income materials we'll be discussing in the weeks ahead. And we will be looking at finding a complementary manager to RBC. And then just with some small tweaks to the allocation, that will get us, I think, in very good position, clear allocations and a strategy across both the equity and the fixed components, and continuing to look for managers that offer ESG and private market investments that have strong returns. We're unlikely to see those in the traditional area, but certainly looking at those for ones that have more of a mission alignment. The discussion between the two committees, as many of you know, we do meet together for a portion of the day and meet separately for short periods to discuss more focused business of either SRI or the investment committee. The joint meeting, we did get an update on our community investments, and we started talking about our statement of investment beliefs, which is part of the process of integrating the two committees. We have done a workshop and worked together. We're working together with feedback as the SRI policy has been updated with an established policy and timing of how we update and what type of criteria go into the SRI policy. There's been good input from all members of both committees, and I think it's really helped bring us together. We had a discussion about our ESG screening criteria. Sustainalytics is the provider that we use to help us determine our ESG universe that reflects our values, and Sustainalytics has recently revamped how they do that, and we took a look at that process and the impact that it has on our universe, and to actually look at the results of the impact of our screening, which has been positive and easily visible again in our Rumline manager. I think that covers most of my view on what we did at the investment committee and the joint level. And I know Kathy's got some comments as well from her perspective about the joint meeting and what the SRI committee has been up to. But I really look forward to working with Kathy and the SRI committee as we work on the statement of investment beliefs. I think this is really going to be important work, not only for the UUA, but for all of the investors out there who are looking to have a better grasp of how do we invest and understand the principles and the policy that can help us accomplish all of our goals together. So Kathy, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. That was a great overview of the work that we're doing together, and just to say that I'm also excited about that process of really working on a statement of investment beliefs that reflects our values and helps us provide some structure for thinking about how to integrate a commitment to racial justice at the level of our investment beliefs and both learn from other endowments and investors that are grappling with that question and also potentially contribute to advancing the discussion. And it's also really, really helpful, the work that we've done on the SRI policy to provide clear guidance as to how decisions that are made by General Assembly and the Board of Trustees are reflected in our investments. So if people want to look at the, I think it's slide 9, I believe, there's a update on shareholder advocacy and engagement. We're at the height of proxy season right now, where there's a lot going on with corporate annual meetings, and the UUA is in a leading role. And thanks in particular to Tim and to Susan Hilbert on the staff for enabling us to play a leadership role on key issues, including climate and political and lobbying disclosure. So I know that there was an annual meeting of BlackRock today where UUA was the lead filer, some good coverage and responsible investor, quoting Tim. Tim, I don't know, do you have an update as to what happened with the resolution?
I don't, but I've been in meetings all day. Let me look and see if I have anything.
Okay. While you're doing that, coming up next week is one of the meetings is ExxonMobil, where the UUA is the lead filer on a resolution about disclosure of political spending, and I have the honor of representing the UUA there. So I'll be attending that meeting and presenting that proposal. And we are also continuing to be part of a major institutional investor initiative, the Climate Action 100 Plus, which now has more than $33 trillion in assets under management behind it. It's a 5-year initiative engaging with the highest emitting companies. And so, you know, we're doing a lot of this work under the rubric of the fossil fuel divestment resolution that was passed at General Assembly 5 years ago. And there have been some really important advances in that initiative over the past couple of months. So just this week, BP had a resolution about aligning its capital expenditures with the temperature goals in the Paris Climate Agreement, and the board of the company actually supported that shareholder proposal, so it passed with a 99% endorsement from shareholders. So that's an important signal to the, in particular to U.S. companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron, investors are demanding more ambitious action in terms of addressing climate change. And the lobbying issue is also gaining a lot of traction. Again, they're unfortunately more with European companies. So last month, Shell published a review of the positions taken by its trade associations and how they actually match up with or don't the positions that Shell says it takes on climate change. And as a result of that review, Shell actually decided to leave the American fuel and petrochemical manufacturers because it wasn't consistent with Shell's stated positions. So Equinor has committed to do a similar review. BP apparently committed to that as well. And there are now, I guess, 10 European companies that either have committed to review their climate policy positions or have done it already. So these are important advances and underscored by the urgency of the science of climate change. And we're looking forward to highlighting these and other advances on climate change issues and the role of the EUA at General Assembly next month. Tim, did you find anything on that, or?
No, I haven't.
Okay, interesting.
Yes, one of our committee members was at the meeting and presented the proposal, but I have not heard anything back from Vonti yet. So,
okay, all right.
And I don't think they post this yet. I think they wait for the 8K will come out in a day or two.
They wait for the 8K. Okay. So that's all I've got. Unless Tim, you have anything else to add on the advocacy and engagement side?
No, I think that was a really good summary. As you say, it's been very active. Just one last comment on the point you were making about the disconnect between some companies' public positions and what their trade associations are pushing for. What we hear from senators in the U.S. is that the pressure they feel and the vociferousness of the views from the trade associations basically drown out the company views. So I think this is really critical for companies to start separating from these trade associations and being very out front about it. What they tell us in dialogues is that they're working behind the scenes. But somehow when you work behind the scenes and then there's this perception that let's say the Chamber of Commerce, which says it represents U.S. business, is against climate policy, that's what gets heard in the legislature. So I think this new kind of disclosure where companies are really laying out their views and comparing them to the trade associations is really very important. So with that, I'd like to open up the call for questions. So let me just get this opened.
All guests have been unmuted. All guests have been muted. You can unmute your line by pressing *6.
Okay, so I think all lines are muted except the moderators, but you can unmute your own line by pressing *6. So if somebody wants to try to do that and answer and do a question, go ahead.
My name is Teresa Wilmot from Rockford, Illinois, and I'm calling to ask what's going on with Wells Fargo. It's on the resolutions page.
So, good question. If I sound a little funny, it's because I'm getting an echo, but I'll try to answer that. So we only have a token investment in Wells Fargo. We have a special portfolio where we put shares of companies that we want to be able to engage with, but they're not part of the core portfolio, and they're very relatively small, very small holdings. So ICCR, the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, has been very involved with engaging Wells Fargo for years around their corporate ethics. And that effort has been led by Sister Nora Nash from Philadelphia. She's quite a powerhouse of a person and knows the company extremely well. So the engagement has gotten to the top of the company. Last year we had a meeting with the CEO and the chair of the board. And the most interesting thing the CEO said, he said, Sister Nora, you were right. You were right. You were right. You were right. So that's a quote. So we believe that the company is changing culture, that it is. So they have a statement of ethics, which basically was ignored during all their trouble. And we believe that the company is taking concrete steps to rectify the problems, but also to take this statement of ethics very seriously and push it out through the company. The work is not done either by the company or by the shareholders. We're continuing to meet with them and look for benchmarks of progress on this. But it has been, I think, effective engagement. Is really pushing the company to center their statement of ethics and to implement it within the company's practices.
I have a question about how you choose the companies for shareholder advocacy, and I was wondering, in addition to the fossil fuel companies, why don't you do other types of companies where energy efficiency would save their money? I'm thinking like trucking companies could go to electric vehicles, and big box stores could put solar panels on their roofs and that sort of thing, if you consider that kind of shareholder advocacy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so thank you for that question. It's a good question. So there are really two answers to that. The short one is that we're focused on fossil fuel companies because our General Assembly told us to do that in 2014. There was a business resolution that said either sell off the fossil fuel companies, or if we are engaged with them on the issue of climate change, then they can stay in the portfolio. So there was really a charge from the General Assembly. But maybe the more important part of the answer is that so we are very active members of the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, where we work with most of the other faith groups on climate change and other issues. And we're also very active members of a group called CERES, and they have something called the Investor Network on Climate Risk. So we work collectively with these other investors on exactly some of these issues you're talking about. And the way it works is that we will meet together, review different kinds of resolutions that we think would be effective, including the kind you're talking about energy efficiency. And different investors will volunteer in the meeting to take on a particular company on a particular issue. So we can't do everything. We do more, though, than just the fossil fuel companies. For instance, we've been very engaged with Xcel Energy over several years. This is one of the largest electric utility companies in the country, and they very recently committed to zero emissions by 2050 and 80% reduction by 2030. And this is a very serious commitment from the company. They have plans on how to do this. They are retiring coal plants well before their useful lives and switching to renewable energy. So what you say is correct. There are a lot of different efforts from shareholders to press companies in different sectors, and it just depends on the company and the sector as to what the most appropriate approach is. But so we feel good that we support and are active in networks that take this kind of action. But, you know, we're small. We can't do everything ourselves, but we do try to do as much as we can.
Thank you. What was the company that you said that is switching to renewables and retiring coal companies and so on? I missed the name of that.
Xcel. It's spelled X-C-E-L.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And if those who have asked questions would hit *6 again to mute your lines, that'd be great. Do we have another question? *6 to unmute your phone. Wow, I can't believe nobody has a question.
Well, I have another one if I can ask again. And I'm Eleanor Hall in First Church in Chicago. I was looking through the list of holdings for March 2019, and I noticed several companies where we have a very small number of shares, like Coca-Cola, 100 shares, $4,686. Regency Centers Corporation, 15 shares, $1,012.33. Why would we have less than $1,000 in a particular company in some cases? I mean, it just seems like there might be fees associated with these companies that it really wouldn't be cost effective if you only have a few shares.
Yeah, okay, that's a good question. What you're really talking about is what we call our advocacy portfolio. So it's on the holdings list. It's the last section of it. It says shareholder advocacy holdings. So that's where we're holding a few shares in a company, really just because we want to be able to engage with them. So when we do our screening process that Kathleen was talking about, using data from Sustainalytics, companies will get knocked out because they don't meet our thresholds on environmental performance or social performance or good corporate governance. But we may want to engage with them anyway, or at least be able to participate in meetings. So we'll, you know, set aside $4,000 or $5,000 of stock. The other thing is that whenever you file a resolution with a company, you have to have held at least $2,000 of the stock for a year, and you need to have that to maintain that holding until the annual general meeting. And if you don't do that, then your shareholder resolution will get thrown out. So because the portfolio is really not managed by us, we hire managers to make the investment decisions. Those managers are trading along the way. They're, you know, buying companies and selling companies. And you don't want to be in a position where, you know, they've purchased, you know, let's say Bank of America, you file a resolution, and then along the way they decide, well, that's not such a, you know, the stock has gone up and we want to sell it. And they sell it, and there you are standing there without any stock, and you have to, your shareholder resolution cannot go forward at the annual general meeting. And, you know, I tell you that from painful experience. That has actually happened to us. So now what we do is as soon as we file a resolution, we take about $5,000 of stock and we put it into this advocacy portfolio, which we control. So that's kind of the long answer to your question. You know, and as far as any smaller holdings, you know, just kind of in the, I'm not seeing the one you're talking about, but anyway, sometimes in our index portfolio, just kind of randomly, there will be, you know, small holdings because there might be a stock split or there might be a dividend paid in shares, that sort of thing. But mostly it's the advocacy portfolio where you see those small holdings. And by the way, there are no fees attached to that. The fees are just when you buy and sell. There are no fees for just holding the shares.
Tim,
go ahead.
From Church of the Restoration, where do I see this bundle of money for the purchase of shares for resolution purposes?
It's in the holdings report. So if you go to the UUCEF website and you look at reports, The 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth item down is holdings and community investments. And then you can, the most recent one, we do it quarterly, so the most recent one is March 2019. And then if you go to that report, down near the bottom is the section that shows the advocacy portfolio.
I thought I would see it in the regular statement, but it's not there.
Yeah, I think we lump that with the community investments because they're both kind of about, anyway, so they're both kind of related to each other. They're both very small. So there's right now there's $486,000 in the advocacy portfolio.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Tim, yeah, this is Larry Cooper, Tri-County UU. I see under human rights, Sun Trust is the only company you're working with regarding human rights. What is the issue there, and are there any other companies which you are working on human rights issues with?
Yeah, that's the only active engagement right now. Again, you know, we work with ICCR, Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, and, you know, they do tremendous amount of work on human rights that we support. The particular issue with SunTrust Bank, and that, by the way, was filed, co-filed with the United Church of Christ, they actually provide a fair amount of funding to a company that is incarcerating immigrants and were involved in incarcerating immigrant children. You know, we've been talking to them about that, expressing our outrage at that kind of financing, asking them to change their policies and to put an explicit human rights policy in place to govern their lending. We had a similar engagement with J.P. Morgan Chase, which is, of course, one of the biggest banks in the world. And they just maybe 2 weeks ago or something announced that they would no longer provide any financing to the private prison industry. So we're trying to get other banks to do similar things. We've engaged SunTrust in the past about sustainability reporting, and I'll just say they're a little bit challenging.
Okay.
But we're going to keep at it.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
This is Curtis Bell in Portland.
Hey, Curtis.
Hi, yes. I had one question for Kathy and another second question for anyone. The statement on investment policy that reflects our values, I wonder what the status of that is. Is that something that's in progress? Is that something that's available? Is it something that's planned? That was the first question. And then I wondered, how does the interaction with Sustainalytics go? Do you tell them what you want and they provide a screen, or do you take screens off of a shelf that they have of different kinds of screens? That was a second question.
Great. This is Kathy. So the SRI guidelines update process has been underway for a while now, probably 3 or 4 meetings, and we're very close. We had a couple of bits of language that we wanted to do some vetting with other players in the human rights space. So when that is approved by the Socially Responsible Investing Committee and with support from the Investment Committee, it would then have to be approved by the Board of Trustees. So I think we're underway to do our remaining committee work on that in the next month or so, and ideally be able to forward it to the board in the next few months. And then as far as how we work with Sustainalytics, I can start that, and Tim and Kathleen, feel free to add. Sure.
Curtis was also asking about the statement of investing belief.
Oh, right. Yeah. So those are two different two different statements and documents. So one of them, we have had SRI guidelines, and you can see the ones that are currently operative on the UUCEF website. And this is an update and I would say adding more specificity back into those guidelines. They've evolved over the years to reflect decisions made by General Assembly and by the Board of Trustees. And so we're seeking actually to add some granularity back in that will be more guiding for the screening process and also for our shareholder advocacy and engagements. The statement of investment beliefs is, Kathleen or Tim can speak to this. They are fairly common for institutional investors or to have statements of investment beliefs and making explicit the beliefs that are operating and guiding the fund. And in this case, we are looking to integrate into that some of the learnings from the session that our joint committees had on racial justice and our investments in February of this year, and to also build on some work that's happening through the Transform Finance network of investors. So, Kathleen, do you have anything to add on those?
Yeah, I would just add that I think we're very early stage with that, and it's, you know, I think some investors are doing this now, but it's still kind of unusual. The idea is to really set, this is like a higher level. This is, you know, more general.
Sorry.
Pardon me?
I got to go. Our office is apparently evacuating, so I'll let you all finish.
Thank you. Thanks. Good luck getting out.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. The statement of investment beliefs is kind of higher level. It's almost like a philosophy. It'll include some core investment assumptions and also some statements about how we believe environmental, social, and governance issues affect investments. But we're just getting started with it. There's nothing written yet. So that'll be a while before there's anything public. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so then, Curtis, you also asked about how the Sustainalytics work. So remember, Sustainalytics is a data provider and analyst. They analyze data the way we tell them to. So we identify the issues that are of importance to us. So this is coming right out of the investment policy statement. And for instance, I know you, in your work, you really focused on human rights, and particularly human rights in Israel-Palestine. So we will tell them, you know, this is a category that we want companies to be scored on, and this is also a category where we want to be alerted to controversies. And then it's the score and the controversies that it's kind of an algorithm almost that then determines, you know, which are the companies that fall below our threshold for investment. So it's kind of a two-step process where we give them the issues, they do the scoring and the analysis and also identify and score controversies, and then we have a formula that then takes all that data and determines whether a company is eligible for investment. So any other questions? We're getting near the end of our time. I think we have time for one more.
This is Brad from Church of the Restoration with a general question. Many of our churches do not yet participate in the Common Endowment Fund, nor do other support UU groups of varying kinds do not invest. And then, of course, we have lots of individuals who seek assistance with their investments and are not eligible to invest in the Common Endowment Fund. Where do individuals or churches who don't want to be in CEF get guidance for socially responsible ESG-type investments?
Mm-hmm.
This is a need that many of our churches and our UUs have, and there is no place that I know of that can systematically provide information for people who want to vote intelligently on the issues that many of the proxies present.
Mm.
Where can individuals or non-participating churches get information so they can vote their proxies intelligently?
Well, that's you know about this, Brad, because you know you were involved when we were working with an organization that was trying to provide that kind of service to small institutions, and they went away. It didn't; their business didn't work.
Right.
And as far as I know, nothing has emerged.
Right.
I mean, there is a group out in San Francisco. I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's a proxy advisor that's affiliated with As You Sow, and they will vote proxies for $39 a company, which is fairly cheap, but for an individual, it's a lot of money, and they don't publish that guide. Individuals can look at the UUA's proxy voting policy, so if they want to vote their own proxies, they can see a very detailed policy that actually lists every issue that comes up, or virtually every issue that comes up in annual meetings, and follow that, because we, you know, there's a lot of research behind that. We use institutional shareholder services to do the research, and that those recommendations are available. But it is challenging for the individual or the small institution. I mean, the only other thing I would say is that depending on the size of your portfolio, if you are using a an investment advisor or broker, you could ask them to vote your proxies and give them the UUA guidelines and see if they would vote those on your behalf. Those are my thoughts. It's like a hole in the market that no one has really filled. So I hear what you're saying, and I think it is a problem, but I don't know of a good solution beyond what I've said.
Okay. Thank you, Tim.
Okay, so it is 3:59. It's time to wind up our call. I just wanted to say to everybody, as many of you may know, I'm stepping down as Treasurer and Chief Financial Officer at the end of the fiscal year. And so there will be somebody else on this call the next quarter. It's been fantastic working with all of you and your investments, and I hope we can keep up this good performance at least till I'm gone, because this is a really nice report to be able to deliver to all of our investors in the Common Fund. It's been a real privilege and honor to have this position, and this, by the way, don't tell anybody, but this is the favorite part of my job, working on our Common Endowment Fund and working with the Investment Committee and the SRI Committee. So thanks, everybody, for joining today, and strap on your seatbelts. It's going to be kind of volatile, but I think our committee is really on top of our portfolio and doing a great job. Thanks, all.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks,
thank you, Tim.